Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 67 of NML Crossing, which is kind of becoming habitual here. These shows are coming out, or not coming out, but being recorded. They're getting recorded later in the day every time here. Had a lot of, you know, when you have like a day full of appointments and like they're never like perfectly placed. You know, it's not like, okay, well, this half hour is this, then this half hour is that. It's like, well, here's this, and then you have like 45 minutes where there's nothing going on, but you can't really start anything or do anything because you got to get going again. It's such a pain in the ass, but here we are. I found a few moments today to get this piece recorded. So how about we hop right in? Today we're kicking off a two-parter. This is Batman Legends of the Dark Knight, number 119, which had a July 1999 cover date. The story is Claim Jumping, Part 1, written by Greg Rucka with pencils by Mike Diodato, inks Wayne Foucher, colors Roberta Tooze and Wildstorm FX, letters Willie Schubert, edits Illidge, Gorfinkel, O'Neill, cover price $1.99. Now we open on a map of No Man's Land, and we haven't seen one of these maps in quite a while. I believe this one is Oracle's, since she's going to be doing a lot of our narration here. Now, the included key with this map has a few names crossed out, indicating that they no longer control any of the neighborhoods. And those X'd off names are Black Mask, and we saw him get taken away, the Low Boys, the Mad Hatter, who... Did we do a Mad Hatter story that I forgot about? I mean, beside that, like, Aftershock bit with, who was that hooded geek? Narcosis? The Dream Gas guy? I don't think we've done anything with the Mad Hatter since then, though my memory could be spotty at times. Maybe I talked about him for a half hour and completely forgot about it. It's possible. Another name, X'd off, is the Scarecrow, then Scarface, and finally the Street Demons. Now, our narration waxes on about the concept of land, and how, in times like this, it's what everybody is vying for. It's also day 127 of No Man's Land, and it's the end of winter. And it's not quite the worst winter on record, though, all things being relative, it's one where many Gothamites had to endure it without the luxury of heat, and in a lot of cases, the luxury of shelter. Now, we even get a glimpse of a couple of landers attempting to cross the frozen river in order to escape to civilization, only to be blown up real good by a mine all the same. We shift scenes over to a confab between a pair of NML movers and shakers. It's the Penguin and Two-Face. To which, hey, I thought Two-Face was a good guy now. Like, didn't we just read that? And, I mean, both that and this story were written by the same dude? Huh. Okay. Anyway, they are plotting and planning on ways they might expand their territories and possibly even take down the Batman. Now, Rucka gets almost insanely technical here, and it's really, really cool. Like, they're bargaining and they're talking about, like, everybody on all of their borders, all the neighboring gangs, all the potential threats to their little fiefdoms. It's really cool. And Harvey is looking to move into Blue Boy territory, I think. I think it's a lot of moving parts here. So he's looking to move into Blue Boy territory and also take out Batman, which would help both gangs out. Ozzy can do what he's got to do. Two-Face can do what he's got to do. And in order for this to all kind of happen, all the Penguin's got to do is start spreading some information in order to bait the Bat. If you remember, when Batman and Penguin decided to play nice, or when, I guess, when Penguin was forced to play nice with Batman, the contingency there was that any and all information that the Penguin got would have to get to Batman. Good, bad, indifferent, Batman needed to know everything. So, Ozzy's a pretty good facilitator of information. We jump to the next day where Oracle is trying to get in touch with Batman. Only it's a different Bat who answers the call. And as you might imagine, this is a fairly contentious conversation, and it's really, really well done. It's like Barbara even calls herself petulant after the fact, because it's a lot of hurt feelings here. And Batgirl plainly says, like, hey, you don't like me, do you? And Babs is very quick to confirm that. She also reveals that she happens to know who's under the Batgirl mask before, you know, abruptly disconnecting the call. Turns out Batman was with Babs all along, Babs didn't know it, and Batman informs her of her unprofessionalism. Babs claps back, saying that he's got no right to say such a thing, especially considering she knows who Batgirl is. Huh, someone unprofessional, you say? Hmm. Anyway, Oracle's got that Pengi intel, which is all about some moves that Two-Face is currently making. And it basically has to do with a fight club with a judge and jury. You remember, like, 7 or 8 episodes ago, we wrapped up, I think it was the Mosaic storyline, the Black Mask one, and we wrapped up with a cutaway to that odd trial where someone was found guilty for something they didn't even know they did or couldn't even figure out what it was, and we had the tally man doing some stuff. Well, I think this is that. Now, Batman decides he's going to look into it. Barbara warns him that this is probably a trap, which, I mean, da-doy. From here, we hop over to the GCPD, where Commissioner Gordon is holding court. We get a lot more insane chatter about borders, lands, who's got it, who wants it. It's really, really well done. It's like I almost got lost in it, because there's just so much information here, and it's a lot of information, but it's told in a very conversational way. Like, we had Penguin and Two-Face exchanging the information here. Now we have Gordon kind of lecturing the Blue Boys on it. Very, very well done. But I'm very, very dense, so it's a little hard to keep track of, but it is very, very well done. Anyway, Gordon says that their next plan of action is to take Penguin's piece of the No Man Land, and our friend Foley, he pipes up to suggest that this be madness. Hardbox says they can maybe try securing the perimeter around Robinson Park before they do this, which Foley ain't digging either, since, you know, Poison Ivy controls that place, and, well, I mean, Poison Ivy in a park? That's going to be trouble, isn't it? Now, he says they should probably focus on taking down a smaller threat, like the Josa. Who, didn't they get taken out, like, in that other arc? Like, where Gordon made a deal with someone we never saw, and they took care of it for him? We saw, like, all those bodies strewn out? I'm kind of getting discombobulated here. Maybe I'm mistaking my gangs. Maybe I'm conflating my gangs. I really don't know. Anyway, Gordon is... Am I saying anyway a lot? I feel like I am. Anyway, Gordon is steadfast in his position that they take on the Penguin. Foley attempts to reason with him one more time, reminding him and the entire Blue Boy squad that the Penguin happens to have a friggin' arsenal. Gordon says he knows all that. And also, that they'll be taking those weapons and whatnot. Foley says Gordon is going to get them all killed. Like, he's in his face, spitting on him here. It's like real, real close quarters. He also compares him to a petty dictator before stomping his feet and storming out of the room. We jump to a few moments later, after the meeting is, you know, everybody's dismissed and everybody leaves. Hardbach remains. And he approaches Gordon to... sort of kind of agree with Foley. He says... You know, we're outmanned, we're outgunned, we're out everything here. We're probably not going to win this fight. And what happens if we lose? Well, Gordon doesn't seem fazed, and nor does he argue. He simply says there's no other way. They got to do this, or else. Because if they lose, chaos is going to take over. There'll be no getting Gotham back. From here, we shift scenes over to Blackgate, where Two-Face arrives with some payola for the KG Beast. Now, he's there in order to chat up a resident and use her for his bat trap. And so we follow him into the, the hallway of cells, and we find out he's meeting up with Black Widow? That kind of looks like her, but it ain't her, of course. It's some girl named Isabel Cheranova. Anyway, Harvey chats her up and enlists her into his cause. Well, kinda. I mean, he actually tells her she doesn't have any choice in the matter. It's like, you're gonna do this because you're gonna do this. And he touches her face and he brushes her bangs off her forehead, which reveals solar panels? I really don't know. Maybe she's a robot. I'm not sure. The next day, Gordon and Montoya have a secret meeting where he tasks her with doing something a bit unethical, a bit under the table. Even saying if she gets caught, he's going to deny everything. He's going to sell her down the river. She's on her own, so don't get caught. She tells him that he has her full trust and that she is game. We don't find out what he asks. We don't find out anything, really. All we see is moments later, she leaves the room and passes by Sarah Essengordon, who asks what's up. Renee says nothing. She says nothing a few times and then leaves. Sarah then enters the room suspiciously, saying nothing a few times herself. From here, we jump to one of Batman's safe houses where he's informing Batgirl of his plan. And that plan, of course, is that he's going to crash Harvey's Fight Club. Which Batgirl is sure is a trap, and she demands to come with. Batman is also sure this is a trap, but tells her to stay put all the same. And so, from here, we follow our hero to a lookout point where he can watch the fight play out. And the fight's going to be between some jacked-up goon called Rhino and his opponent. Well, we'll find that out in a little bit. But first, let's return to the GCPD, where Sarah is trying to plead her case for coming with when the Blue Boys march into Penguin Land. Now, this conversation is interrupted by the returning Renee Montoya, who asks to speak with the commish in private. Sarah begrudgingly leaves. She is not happy. Once she's gone, Renee informs Jim that he will give them his full support at midnight. In fact, it's already taken care of. Now, what it is, or who he is, we might have some guesses, but can't say for sure. Renee leaves, but not before telling Jim that, with this very play, they sold their souls. Now, we jump back to the Fight Club, and we see Rhino's opponent. And, of course, it's Isabelle What's-Her-Face, who is wildly outmatched, and nearly beaten to death in no time flat. If not for a trio of well-placed batarangs and a missile dropkick from our hero. Batman reaches for the poor gal so he can swoop her to safety, and just then, the clock strikes midnight. At which time, Two-Face, the Penguin, and Commissioner Gordon all synchronize their swatches. We wrap up with Batman bringing Isabelle to safety, at which time she clobbers him over the head with a lead pipe. It was a swerve, bro. That's where we leave it. Next time out, we're going to wrap up Claim Jumping in Shadow 87. Now, before we talk about this issue, we do have a pretty hefty letters page here. It's all folks talking about the No Man's Land one-shot. I guess they didn't get much mail on Legends of the Dark Knight. I don't know. They are all, I'm pretty sure they're all via the internet. Maybe more specifically via AOL for some of them. We're going to start with Sophia via the internet. Now, Sophia loved the No Man's Land one-shot and promises to keep with the new direction as long as it's able to maintain this level of quality. She especially enjoyed Alex Maleev's ability to tell a story. Next up, Jason via the internet. He is a bit conflicted over the use of crossover in the Batman books. He says he loved the Nightfall saga and, well, he found a lot of what came after couldn't quite live up to it. It all felt underwhelming and had far lower stakes. He says that the subsequent crossovers, such as Contagion, were good, but he kind of worried about the artificiality of having to manufacture these crises to facilitate these big stories. He came into Cataclysm with a fair amount of cynicism and was prepared to be underwhelmed. He compared it to the fall of Metropolis, which we've discussed before, and how it started with the city being destroyed and ended with, well, silliness, a deus ex machina, if that's how you say those words. He worried about the same being true for Gotham. Despite his pessimism, he did enjoy Cataclysm. Aftershock, however, well, he thought that was a boring dud, largely because he kept waiting for that shoe to drop. He kept waiting for that deus ex machina to fix everything. On the road to No Man's Land, get this, Jason found optimism. In, of all places, the introduction of Nicholas Scratch. He compares Nick to a mix between Marilyn Manson and Rush Limbaugh. Okay. He actually enjoyed Asriel getting a bit of play. Okay. And he also enjoyed Jerry Arkham being trapped in his own asylum there for a minute. And that was a really fun story. I will agree with that. He found himself completely blown away by the No Man's Land one-shot. He loves the villains having their little fiefdoms. And he dug the ruthlessness of this new take. And he cites the ventriloquist killing someone for a cookie and the penguin taking a bite out of that very expensive auctioned-off apple. He says it's frightening and exciting, and he compares it to an Elseworlds, but better, because it's happening in the mainstream DCU. He compares the entire thing to the legend of King Arthur and can't wait to see how Batman winds up taking back his kingdom. He says the cross event has been successful in persuading him to buy and read all of the Bat and Bat-adjacent titles. So there's a... I mean, these are all going to be pretty glowing praise for the No Man's Land one-shot, except for one. And I mean, we covered that one, well, some time ago, and I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. It was, you know, I compared it to, you know, The Wizard of Oz, where it's black and white and then it's color, you know? Everything kind of made sense when we got that one shot, and it just kicked things off spectacularly. Next up, Dave in Los Angeles, who, like everybody else so far, was initially skeptical about No Man's Land. Couldn't imagine there being a Gotham City without a Batman, a Robin, a Batcave, Batsignal, etc. But he absolutely loved the No Man's Land one-shot, and he wonders who the new Batgirl might be. But, dun-dun-dun, has a question about the internal logic of the story. You remember the internal logic, right? He says, quote, "Why doesn't the Justice League come in and rebuild it? You gotta think Green Lantern and Supes could do it in a few days." To which the editor directs us to the upcoming Batman 566, which we will be looking at in two episodes' time. I believe that's The Visitor. I think that's where Superman does show up and Batman kind of tells him to hit the bricks. But it's been ages since I read it, and it's one that I've been looking forward to since we started this project. So two episodes from now, we will discuss that one. Next up, Karen via AOL, who, like everybody else, was worried upon hearing about No Man's Land, and was worried that she'd be stuck buying a whole lot of books she wouldn't normally pick up in order to keep up with the story. But she loved the one-shot. She cites the depiction of Jim Gordon as a highlight, and also really dug Babs's new role as a chronicler. Next up, Andy via AOL, who hadn't bought a Bat book since Nightfall, but, out of curiosity, decided to pick up No Man's Land number 1 and was completely blown away. He compares it, with apology, to the X-Men Age of Apocalypse storyline, because, in his words, it actually felt like something big had happened. He digs seeing Gordon question his relationship and reliance on Batman. He can't wait for Harley Quinn to show up, and he is intrigued by this new Batgirl. Next up, Anonymous, via the internet. And this is the holdout here. This is the sole negative comment about No Man's Land. Unsigned is how they sign it. Thinks No Man's Land is a ludicrous concept, stating that the United States would never cut off a city like Gotham. We get all internal logic-y, talking about financial collapses and whatnot. He says that, they say that they won't be buying any more Bat books until No Man's Land is firmly in the rear view. They wrap up by pleading with DC to end this ludicrous No Man's Land just as quickly as possible. Now, our final letter comes from Paul from Parts Unknown. He loved the one-shot. He digs seeing the GCPD engage in what he calls Punisher-like tactics, which I'm sure the DC editors love to see. He looks forward to seeing how the Joker operates in this new normal. And, I hope he didn't read that Azrael, because that was not great. And he hopes that No Man's Land lasts for years and years and years. Boy, could you imagine that? You guys wouldn't be rid of me for a very, very long time. Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. But what did we think about this issue? I really, really dug it. This felt like a return to form, in a way. And, you know, like we've talked about, I'm following a certain triptych here. You know, I'm following a certain reading order, which is by no means gospel. You know, I probably should have looked at what's included in the omnibuses and seeing what order those are, but I'm not even sure the Azrael issues are in that. So, the Lord only knows where we put those. But I'm following one of several that I came across. So maybe there could have been a better way to work our way through it without such... Yeah, I hate calling them lulls because they really weren't. But, you know, I'm not sure how to word it because I don't want it to sound like I'm dismissing the issues we covered over the past several episodes, but they did feel a little bit lesser then. You know, they were good. Not Asriel, but Asriel was good in its own way. Asriel was good in a different way. But we had the trio of one-shots, which, as I mentioned and said many, many times, they felt like they should have just been crammed into a Chronicles issue. Then we had the Asriel two-parter, or with two issues of Asriel, I guess. And then we had Chronicles itself, which was definitely better, you know, in my opinion, than the, you know, five or so episodes before that. But this here feels like... is it too much to just say, like, real No Man's Land? Where everything else kind of feels peripheral? I'm sure there's a better way to describe it or to put into words how I feel about it, but I suppose I could say that reading this issue brings me back to the excitement when we started No Man's Land proper. You know, the anything can happen sort of thing, the grittiness, the under-the-table dealings here, the immorality, the win at any cost, by any means necessary, the real cutthroat nature of No Man's Land. And yeah, it's nice to get the asides from, you know, the random No Man's Lander. We can meet up with Sarge, we can talk about cutting babies in half, you know, all that silly stuff. But this feels more like what I expected when we started this project. It feels more like what I remember No Man's Land being from those abridged trades, you know, 20-odd years ago. And, you know, now that we're, you know, back in form here, it's another issue that is totally stolen by the Gordons, right? Jim's, you know, he's getting to be full-on corrupt now. You know, any means necessary. Strange bedfellows and all that. He's, you know, we get the feeling here, we know, because we've seen this play out already, that Gordon's doing some underhanded stuff with some underhanded people, which is probably why he's not quite nervous about going into the Penguin's territory, right? Just like with whichever gang that was last time, I thought it was Zajosa. Maybe I was wrong, I don't know, but Gordon, you know, going into that territory flew in the face of common sense, but he pressed on anyway because he knew what was going on. He knew that the fix was in, which is probably why he is totally cool going into territory where they are outmanned and outgunned, because he knows something's happening on the back end that's going to, you know, register in the Blue Boy's favor. Foley, once again, is the voice of reason, and is the sole voice of reason here. Nobody else is really piping up. Bach, he was a little bit suspicious or a little bit worried, but didn't argue, didn't clap back at Gordon, which is odd. You know, there's like no free thinkers in the GCPD besides Foley, and maybe Sarah, because I think she's starting to realize that there is something going on under the surface that she is not privy to, which, as I think she called herself a general's wife during this issue. Now, as a general's wife, you'd probably want, you're the general's wife, and you're also boots on the ground, so you probably want to be in on some of this information. So I'm looking forward to seeing how this all plays out. I'm looking forward to seeing how it's revisited and how it's eventually addressed, because, you know, it's eventually going to have to be. Now let's talk about the other Gordon. Let's talk about Barbara, which the scene, it was such a short scene. It was less than a page, I think, where Babs is talking to Batgirl, which is weird to say, isn't it? You know, Babs talking to Batgirl. I know she wasn't Batgirl for a while, but since 2011, she's been in and out of the costume quite a bit. But the conversation she had with the new Batgirl was pretty cool. I liked the contention there. I like the, I don't want to say cattiness, the petulance, let's say, where, because I mean, that's, you know, petulance is the word that Barbara herself used. She makes no bones about not liking the new Batgirl. Now, I don't know if the new Batgirl knows that Oracle was once Batgirl. I keep forgetting how widely known the Barbara was Batgirl story is spread. I think I mentioned a couple episodes ago that I didn't know if Jim Gordon knew it. And I still don't. So for all I know, this new Batgirl knows that Oracle was Batgirl. She might not know who Oracle is in the first place. So maybe we'll find out more about that as we continue our journey. But we do know one thing. Babs knows who the new Batgirl is. Says that unprofessionalism is kind of this this Bat person's stock in trade. So it's someone we know. Wonder who that could be. Maybe we'll find out in, probably just a few issues, because Market Cane is coming up, and that will mark something. Overall, though, this was a really, really good issue. I really enjoyed it. Like I said, it feels like a return to form, and I am looking forward to the next part, and I'm also looking forward to the issue we cover after Claim Jumping, which, again, is The Visitor, where Superman shows up and has a less than pleasant exchange with our Dark Knight detective. But I think that's about all I got to say about this issue. And, well, since I'm kind of pressed for time, we're going to skip the Enna mailbag for today. Though, with that said, I do invite and encourage anybody who'd like to join in on the conversation to, join in on the conversation. You can reach me several different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, and weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com. There's also all the social media places and the Bada Bin Show on YouTube. But that's all I got for today. I'd like to thank you all so much for choosing to spend a little bit of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks, starting over when the story's got an astounding twist.